What's up, everybody? This is Carrick with ACG, and welcome to the Best Gaming Podcast, where today it's actually just going to be me. And the main reason for that is that Comcast is upgrading the old internet near my home, and so I decided I was going to do this podcast on my own the day before and upload it at the same time. If you like it, give it a thumbs up, share it, comment. I'm going to ask you some questions, talk about some stuff. I'd love to hear you guys' feedback on this. I want to say thanks to all the patrons. Thanks to all the people in the Discord. YouTube members can get access to the Discord. We've had a bunch of people jumping in, streaming all the different games. It's a good community to talk about games. I would love to have you join. Let's just jump straight on into this. First thing I want to talk about is bad bosses in games. So this came up in our Discord. We were talking about those bosses that didn't resonate with us, those bosses that didn't reflect their powers in games. And I'm sure a lot of you are probably sitting there right now nodding your head because you have some boss that you haven't liked. Feel free to put that in the comments and we'll read them on the Friday podcast if we get a chance. But I asked all the people in the Discord, you know, what's a boss that really didn't resonate? And then later we asked on Twitter, and I'll look at some of those responses possibly during this podcast. One of the ones that I have come up with, and it's really consistently sat with me for years, is Darth Sion from KOTOR 2. And I know that a great deal of people find KOTOR 2 to be a more elegant title than the original, better writing, better choices. And I do see that, but I actually feel that probably because KOTOR was the original, KOTOR 2 coming later, I actually felt that the different elements that went with Darth Revan and all of that really worked for me at a better angle than KOTOR 2. No real issues with KOTOR 2, though. But I do have an issue with one of the bosses, Darth Sion. This is the Avenged Sevenfold style of Darth that we get in KOTOR 2. And that character didn't really resonate, didn't reflect their powers, and was really what I would say to be one of the poorer boss battles that I've experienced in a game, where I was playing it and I was expecting some kind of ultimate twist or some kind of different way in which they reflected that character's powers. And really all you got was a character that was beat out by an old grandmother and another Darth that walked around wearing a mask and, you know, talking in an alien language. It just didn't resonate with me. It didn't reflect what I saw in the game. And I think this discussion about bosses is interesting. It's actually fascinating to me because we're getting it more and more. It's not that we haven't had these discussions more. It's that while we've had boss rush mode kind of games in the past, we certainly have, they have progressed into really what you see in Dark Souls. Now, let me explain that for a second. So in the last decade, we've got more and more of the Dark Souls games. And the Dark Souls games really are mini bosses with bosses. The normal characters definitely at first can be more difficult. And you usually use the powers and abilities and skills that you've got for those smaller numbers of enemies to defeat that boss. And really, when you look at Dark Souls style games, many times the number of enemies is quite low compared to a normal adventure style game or a normal RPG. And with that change, we've had more and more of these discussions where when you do get to a boss in some of these kind of games, those bosses either work really well to require from the player all of the resources that they've learned and understood, all of the skills that they've upgraded, or they don't. And we've definitely seen more of these discussions when you get your Neos and you get your Dark Souls, you get your Surges, you get your Lies of P. These kind of discussions, I think, are just more frequent. Also, more people on the internet, more people with YouTube channels, more people able to communicate with one another, Discords, those kind of things that just didn't exist other than the occasional game forum that existed in the past. So we're just having more conversation around it. Again, it doesn't mean that we've seen a massive number of increases of these types of situations, but I think we have seen a growing number, and that's just because of how games have matured and the different styles and genres that we're getting. However, as you look at open world games, we're starting to get these situations as well, especially when you look at a game like, let's say, GTA, where it would end in a mission. We're starting to get, or not starting to get, but we're getting more of the open world games that have those main boss bad guys, like a Horizon Zero Dawn or Horizon Forbidden West, certainly the Assassin's Creed games, though they've really just adjusted from their initial format, which was an open city, to open land, now open world, depending on where you go. But I think this discussion is fascinating because it not only shows that there's more communication around it by gamers, there's an expectation change as well. And this is something that developers have had to hinge on, they've had to look at and focus on. And it's also one of the reasons why a lot of these bosses, when you finally get to them, it can be difficult for the developers to balance these situations. For example, if you have an open world game, like let's say a Valhalla, I'm just going to use that as an example, and it may be a poor one, but let's just run with it for a second. and you have something like this and you end up facing one of the more difficult side characters, or even when you look at the, I didn't really necessarily find these characters insanely hard, but they were a step up, which is the Valkyries in the God of War games. You have these changes, and if they don't met out, if you have a character that's got a bunch of these abilities and resources, then you can end up wiping the floor with that bad guy, which is what happened, strangely enough, with me and Darth Sion in KOTOR 2. So it's just a fascinating discussion all around it, and there's tit for tat. There's all kinds of people who could say, no, it's never happened. Nothing's got worse. I don't really say that they're worse. In fact, my example is many decades old, but the discussion has definitely grown around it. And I would love to know what you guys think. What's a boss that just didn't resonate for you? And I expect some very old answers, but especially when I asked here recently, I got not only newer answers, but I got the more popular games answers, which are always easy to come by because they're usually discussed more. Even if, let's say, you like a smaller game, they've got really great bosses. A lot of times more people are playing those larger games, maybe the more, not necessarily AAA, but the more widely polished games that everybody are playing. So I would suggest to you, before you comment, maybe think of other games that maybe you don't hear people talking about. This came up also, strangely enough, when we were discussing an Assassin's Creed game, Assassin's Creed 2, I believe, when you fight the politician at the end. It's weird that you punch basically a cranky old pope at the end of that game. So you have all these kind of situations when it comes to bosses, and I find the discussion around them and the balance that developers have to do fascinating. Moving on from there, I want to talk about balance in games. You know, we're seeing all these games with patches and adjustments. And one of the things that's come up with me, and I'd like to know what you guys think, is nerfing single-player games or changing weapons and abilities and such like that in single-player games. We're seeing it more often, though, where you get a single-player game, single-player completely, and you start to see a lot of nerfing. You see a patch that comes out, and you look, and a skill is adjusted. And a lot of gamers sit there going like, okay, listen, why are we changing this if it's a single player game? You know, if it's broken, I can get it. If it's completely shattered and doesn't make sense as a move or power, it's possible that that needs to be nerfed or buffed. But I personally find it a little odd that you get a single player game where, let's say, you just learn a skill that works really well against some of the enemies. I always find it a little bit interesting that through the QA and through the testing, this many times very easy to find situation gets nerfed or buffed later. And a lot of times in the back of my head, I'm a little nervous that it's the developers just reading the internet and saying, oh, people are complaining about it, let's change it. And I have an example of where I personally feel a big change was made to a single player game that quite literally hurt it a great deal and could have been adjusted in a different way. And that's State of Decay 1. So State of Decay 1 had a very unique system at the time, which is a little bit like the pawn system we see in Dragon's Dogma, except without the multiplayer component. So what this was in the original State of Decay, not only did you have your characters that were with you, but when you turned off or walked away from the system and you weren't playing it, it simulated life. And you can actually have characters get hurt or die or get lost because they were continuing the world. What was fascinating about this was later on, the developers had heard complaints. And so instead of changing it or adjusting a mode, they removed it. And I got to tell you personally, as I was rolling into the release of State of Decay 1, I was enamored by that idea. It was one of the original ideas. I purchased this single player game. I bought this game because I wanted my characters to have that difficulty. I wanted the danger there. I thought that was fascinating that this game was doing something completely different. And when that was patched away, and I think it might be added back in now, or maybe there's something that they did now, but for a while it was missing. I felt that the game lost one of the edges it had. This was a game that was janky. It was a game that had FPS problems. It was a game that wasn't performant, but it had something in it that was really different and really felt like there was something unique about State of Decay 1. And that change and that removal of it, especially on the single player side, where you're looking at it going, seriously, you guys remove this, really killed it for me. And I think that's just a good example of how a single player game and the nerfs, the buffs that we see can actually, I would say, harm those initial purchasers, those people who buy into them. I get it, certainly, when you talk about multiplayer games, you talk about battle royales, extraction games where there's multiple people, that makes sense. But when you look at a single player game, patching that out could be the very reason, especially when it's a mode or some world spanning thing. If you want to patch a potion so that it does a little less healing, that's one thing. But if you're removing a very major component of some thing that you really sold the game on, some element that you sold the game on, some aspect that you touted in your PR and your press prior, and then you patch it out, that really left a bad taste in my mouth. And it's a bad taste that obviously you can tell, because two of my examples for a terrible boss and then this patching situation are both from decades old games. They're both from games that are a long time ago. And I've consistently held those as examples that I'm watching out for in future games. So it's not like this situation hasn't happened before. And it's not like those situations are just remotely in any way, shape, or form close by when it comes to your time frame. These are older games where this kind of problem has happened, whether it be, you know, a poor boss battle, or like I said, whether it be this patching issue. But I'd like to know what you guys think about single player games patching stuff, especially when it comes to modes and really removing some element of it. Luckily, I think most developers look at this and decide that doesn't make any sense, and they are, you know, ear to the ground, trying to identify what people like or dislike and trying to make it so that more people will experience and enjoy the game. But when you have a major mode like that, probably best not to remove it completely, right? Next up, I want to talk a little bit about not necessarily Helldivers, but the ongoing online component of some of these games, these war games, where they have somebody ultimately running them. And I want to give a little shout out to Elite Dangerous. Elite Dangerous, for the now the past 15 months, 16 months, has had a major war with their alien race in it, trying to figure out exactly how to destroy them. And this is prior to Helldivers 2, which I know that Helldivers 2, especially when you see it now, it's a more recent game, looks very good, very enjoyable game. It's got good gameplay now. It's patched up all of its issues, or most of its issues, with sign and logging in. But I do just want to shout out that another game has been doing this for quite some time. And I'm always very intrigued by the communal component that exists in, let's say, Elite. And this is something that I think speaks at its core to people who like Helldivers and people who like any other game that has a multiplayer component in this form or in these kind of shapes, where it's everybody against the world despite the overall environment itself. And you have a big change between these two. With Helldivers, it's more of that combat up front, and you can see other people doing stratagems, and you're all fighting the same enemy, and it's mostly just a battle-based game. But you look at Elite, and Elite is such a special bird, pardon the pun, but you look at Elite and you see this different way in which they're handling the entire world. It's a game that when it launched, I still remember back in the day before both were launched and Star Citizen still not out, but you had people saying, oh, Star Citizen is going to allow people to land, blah, 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 blah. And Elite at the time was like, we just have space. And Elite's continually added, unfortunately, not always successfully, but they've continually added elements. And this ultimate war thing is just one more element of the community trying to figure out how to take on the difficulties that are presented to them dynamically. We see a new adjustment that's coming, which is the factions doing all kinds of battle and adjusting the space stations in their look and faction wars. But this overarching war, to me, is the best part. The idea that people can jump into this and try to figure out exactly how to take on the alien menace. And the way that they've introduced it, to me, is fascinating. Remember that Elite is such a massive, massive game. It is, the you know, more akin to No Man's Sky than it is Star Citizen by far. And what you have is them adding this. And there's also other communal elements. If you guys read up on this, you'll find out about the gas station guys, who basically go out, and if you've run out of gas in space, you can ping them and say, hey, I need help. And they'll send a gas station ship or a gas ship to you to gas you up so you can get to the nearest space station. And these have all been built by a community that is presented with the difficulties, presented with the problems that exist within the game world, and come up with their own solutions. This is something that the Elite Dangerous devs have recently talked about, where they said, we've given the people in the game the tools to defeat the alien menace. They just need to figure them out. I love it. I think it's a great idea. And they even stated, hey, if something happens, maybe we'll give some hints, that kind of stuff. We can build it into the game. These overarching DMs that we hear about, these people who are running the games, when you look at Elite, it's more of a team. And when you look at Helldivers, which makes sense because it's a smaller in scope game when it comes to the activities that are going on, it's more of the one DM deciding what to move, where to move them, how the enemies attack, that kind of stuff. These are fascinating to me. And they add an MMO element to the games that really aren't as much MMO as you think. I would say Elite is certainly an MMO. You can definitely look at it and define it as that. And it's grown as it's continued. But Helldivers is really a special one because right now we only see the on-ground component where you have four people and you have mechs and you have this kind of stuff. I personally do not in any way, shape, or form expect that to be the end. And I think that a lot of developers who are doing these kind of things are looking at situations that maybe come available to them 2, 3, 4 years down the line where they start adding different components. You could certainly look at a component in a Helldivers game that didn't involve that kind of combat, involved whether it be space or something to that effect, an RTS style. We're starting to see these kind of games crop up more and more, and I love it. Depending on the engine and how that engine, whatever system it's on, can handle the different technical requirements, the different difficulties that a company may face, I'm excited for this. I love these kind of things. I love the idea of a DM in Helldivers. I love the idea of this overarching double faction war that's going on in Elite. And I'm just reading the headlines, looking at it going, yeah, you know what? I probably don't want to dive into this. We've talked about it in the podcast where I'm like, damn, that's a lot to dive into, especially when I'm reviewing games. But at the same time, it highlights this magic to me that is one of the open spaces in gaming. And that's one of the things I want to talk about. When you look at the open spaces in gaming, there's been a lot of examples of games that I would say now are past my childhood dreams. Let me discuss this just for a second so people understand. And you can certainly give your own examples. No Man's Sky is a good example for me. No Man's Sky is past what I remember taking notes about when I was a kid making a space game. So I was a kid. I was probably 17 at the time, and I was with friends. I was 18 because I just moved out. And I had some friends over, and we were writing what we would do. These were the John Carmack days, the John Romero days. These were the times when, you know, you'd think, hey, man, maybe we can make a game. Maybe we can sit down and make a game. And I remember talking with friends about a space game. And I still have a folder with old notes. This is 2 decades ago. Old notes of different ideas of what a space game would be for me. What everything that it could add. We even had a VR component in it. And this is prior to really VR being a thing other than the established but never released VR that was going to come, or people were thinking might come, for the Sega Saturn. These were just, you know, ancient kind of discussions that we had. And I remember when we had this discussion, writing down my ideas of what a space game would be and what it would allow. No Man's Sky's past it. No Man's Sky's combat is terrible on the ground. It's not good combat. And I would say that it hasn't surpassed the capabilities or the expectations I would have for ground combat in a space game, but it is there generally. Nevertheless, No Man's Sky is a different scene. It's a different procedural generation, the way they add stuff to the game, but it's still there. And we start to see other games have been attempting this in the past. You see games like X3 Rebirth, which really failed to do it. Precursors, which was years and years ago, attempting to do space and land and driving around in different planets. But when I look at the spots of gaming, I start to see that there's this widening of capabilities in games. Even if you just look at an example like Valhalla, where you start, or Origins, where you get these large open world games of the third person, they have the combat, they have the RPG, they have the action, they have the big cinematography, they have these huge, what you would call geographic porn, where they go out there and they take pictures. And what I've found is that a lot of people will look at an indie and say, oh, indies are the only ones trying anything. And I got to tell you, I agree in a way, but I actually also sort of don't. I don't hold indies, AA devs, a single dev, any devs really at a different level. And I've seen some creations be absolutely magnificent in some part of a game. For example, you see the Nemesis system, which is probably going to consistently be discussed for years for the WB. But then you also see the Pawns, which I think are a big step forward from the original Dragon's Dogma. They're not perfect in Dragon's Dogma 2, but there's an attempt there. But what I see is a condensing down and almost this place where there's no particular spot in gaming where I'm like, oh, that's something new. Do I have an issue with that? No, not necessarily. But I do think what we're going to see is more and more games that are doing two or three elements, two or three aspects, for example, FPS, driving, and space, get better and better. And that excites me. That actually does excite me, because No Man's Sky, I don't think they're ever really going to fix the combat. I could be wrong on that. They fixed the space stations just recently in this newest upgrade, which fascinates me, because to me, the space stations were one of the biggest problems other than combat. And the idea that they've gone and changed that, it doesn't necessarily give me hope for combat, but it is exciting. They're also making their fantasy game, so maybe they'll try to repair combat in that game when it comes to on the ground. But we see this where these games and these companies are trying to mix and match, and you see multiple genres over the top of one another, more so than we've ever seen before. And this isn't even just in the AAA space. You see games where you're in space, but maybe you have an RTS component on the ground. You see games that are about base building, but then they're also a shooter. We see this with Kingmakers. They're a smaller company, but they're not the only one doing that. I mean, I love the idea of Kingmakers. I did a video about it, so don't get me wrong. I actually think it looks hilarious in a B-level game. But you've seen other developers do this, and they've been trying to do it for a while. We see one big thing that I think excites me and disturbs me as well when we talk about the overarching genres sort of collapsing on one another is something like Unreal. I'm very excited for Unreal Engine and its improvements to creating games. But also, it's instigated some problems of its own, like its stutter and other problems that they may have when it comes to performance, certain systems and how they do stuff. And you see a lot of people saying, I don't want something to be homogenized. I don't want every game to look like Unreal. I think when you look at these games now, we're starting to see that that will not be the case. Unreal is sort of an open board. Yes, it may be a little easier to create a game that was more difficult 10 years ago, and you can put it in here. I'm not too worried about that. But when we get this situation where all these genres collapse on one another, I'm super excited to see what the next No Man's Sky style game will be and what they'll crash into, what genres they'll put together. I don't want a rhythm game in my space game. I'm not an idiot. But the idea that we can have these other genres pull in, you know, are we going to get some kind of space game where, you know, difficulty is insanely hard when it comes to flying around, which is more on your elite side. But maybe they put that in the game and then they fix some difficulty on the ground and you have something like a mix between Helldivers and space, something that, like I said, wouldn't surprise me if the Helldivers devs are looking at some kind of tree, some kind of idea of what they want to do in the future with some branches on it saying, well, we could add an RTS component to this. We could add a first-person component to this. We could add a space component to this. We could add a troop deployment, you know, something that's more utilitarian for those gamers that don't want to go down and fight. We just have no clue. These are all really exciting to me, and I love the idea of it, but it also does, at the same time, make me a little nervous when we look at, you know, the collapsing of these genres, because I do feel that we're going to get a lot of mistakes as well. And this is something that you can say we saw, you know, I don't know, I'm not really picking on Ubisoft games because there's been a couple that I've really liked. A lot of them are a little mediocre for me. But when you look at something where they're trying to get these mixed in together, I mean, even when you say, look at the engines themselves, you go back just for a second on Unreal, when we see that Far Cry has now decided that they're going to use the same engine as The Division, that excites me greatly, because then we may see something that was technically unfeasible with the normal Far Cry engine, the Deny engine. They canceled that and they've decided to use the engine from The Division. It's actually possible, especially when we see Avatar, to have some game in the future, Division 3 or a Far Cry, where they have a full developed city and then an outdoor area the size of a Far Cry game. That is exciting to me. It is very exciting to me because we could see not necessarily a combination, but a growth in that particular kind of game. Let me give you an example. Currently, Division is pretty city-based. Even their outdoor areas in DC aren't necessarily arboreal. They're not, you know, these huge verdant areas that some, you know, areas outside of the city, but most of it is still city-born. Same thing with Division 1. And you see the Far Cry games, their attempts at cities have been quite terrible. Cuba, for instance, you know, some of the town in Cuba that you go to in Far Cry 6 was revolting. It was just a horrible looking mess. We see this also with Just Cause. Just Cause has never been able to hit a city very well. They can get the destruction and the outer overall jungle locations looking phenomenal, but they can't handle cities. I personally believe that one of the engines, of all the engines I've seen, all the engines I've watched GDCs on, and you guys should definitely go and check out the GDCs, but one of the only engines I've seen that could possibly do this is the engine that is running The Division. It is one of the few engines that might be able to handle this. Now, would it be able to handle the driving that we see in Far Cry, even though that driving is not perfect? I don't know. I don't assume that there would be any issue because it wasn't great in the Far Cry games. Do I think that they could become equal with the Far Cry games, but also have these massive open worlds outside of cities? Yes. And then what you have is a change in The Division, or the idea of a future game coming out where they break out of the division, because I think with Division 3, they are going to sort of have to look at what we do. Does the Division 3 have a completely different style where it's got some city missions and some outdoor missions that are in a wide open area? It just, we don't know, but it excites me. And it excites me as much as Unreal. I see that engine and I see them making great strides with that engine. And I see a lot of developers, including those we know, including Reg, who's on the podcast, who's using it. You see a lot of people very excited about what they can do. And they're not excited for just the technical stuff. And they're not excited for just the savings that they may get. But it seems like a lot of developers are excited for their ability to iterate. Something the Unity engine was known for a great deal of time versus Unreal. Where the Unreal engine, there were a lot of people saying, hey, we can make it more performant. But the Unity engine has some issues with performance. However, we can quickly turn around and make something in Unity a little easier. And it seems like it's now come to the point where Unreal can do both. And that's fascinating to me. Not necessarily super excited to see any particular game. There's no games that are out there that I'm not talking about or that I'm keeping secret. I'm just looking at what developers are saying and what they're excited to be able to do in their turnaround. And that's not including AI, which is a contentious and ultimately, I think, not necessarily futile discussion, but certainly a discussion that we will probably have to look at AI and just assume that a great deal of developers are going to use it for different things and will become more accustomed to how those work, more accustomed to the workflows, more accustomed to the impact on people and their jobs. That's just the way AI works. It is going to happen no matter if we want to put a foot down or not. And the weird thing is, especially when you look at the delivery of these titles, people could put a foot down and say, I don't want to accept any AI of any kind. And they would not be aware that for many years, many versions of AI have already been used. And so there is no clear definitive cutoff for that. So these are all just different technical things that I'm fascinated by. I'm really excited for, despite the crushing down that I said we've seen of a lot of games where there's multiple genres in one game. I think that when we look at this, we're still seeing those side games. We're still seeing rhythm games, but I don't know. I'm not saying there's no innovation to be made, because I do think there is. It's just that I think innovation probably will look a different way in the coming years. It won't look like, let's say, a Rock Band, because I think currently with our economy and the way games cost and microtransactions and the way they're looked at, I think that games like that that sell you, let's say, for $120, the instrument, those kind of things, they might have already passed their big point. Nothing wrong with that, but a lot of gamers, especially with the advent of YouTube and all of this kind of thing, a lot of gamers aren't going to want to spend money on 5 buttons on a controller to fake a guitar that doesn't really teach them real guitar, which is why something like Rocksmith has been created, which is a real game, but also a real teacher. So I'm fascinated to see where all of this is coming. And this might sound a little disjointed because it's just me bouncing off myself when it comes to the discussion with nobody else to bounce off of. But I really can't wait to see these changes. I can't wait to see how gaming's going. And I understand all of the problems with gaming. There's tons of them. But at the same time, I can't fight off the idea that there's going to be some awesome stuff that even I'm not recognizing. And when we see what happened with VR attempted and then failed, AR is now sort of trying to come along, AR/VR, glasses, that kind of stuff, until we see some kind of instantly available system that's not going to really take off. It hasn't taken off for PlayStation. They're now trying to make it available for they have made it available for PC, but you still need a PlayStation. It's a very weird situation there. But I think that with VR, I was really excited for that because it was another dimension. It was the ability to do the 3D game, interact with the game environments, that kind of stuff. And it really doesn't seem like it's going anywhere until there's a big change to the hardware and the delivery and the iterations. I'm really excited for that. One thing I'm a little nervous about is early access. And I've talked about this in the podcast a lot of times. I don't know what you guys think, but especially with early access lately and the litany of problems we've had with early access games not coming out, or early access games being abandoned, as well as finished games being abandoned. There's this odd thing where the finished games are abandoned and the early access games, some of them are abandoned. And so I've started to find almost a growing reluctance to jump into early access games anymore, because if even the great big games where a bunch of money is spent aren't succeeding at times, then the idea that a smaller game where people are just wanting money for a promise have become even more worrisome. And early access games, in particular for me, have been about a 50-50 crapshoot, especially when it comes to coverage of the games. I don't know about you guys and how you guys have dealt with it, but I've certainly noticed that really when it comes to covering them, about 50% of the early access games that I've covered have come out and delivered even close to what they said, and about 50 haven't. And it's become this situation where it's really hard to get excited for an early access game anymore, because I just don't know what that game's going to be. And it sort of revolves us all the way back to the starting discussion about State of Decay. So you look at State of Decay, and this was a finished game where they patched out one of the modes that I really liked. You have even less of a chance, less of a vested interest from the dev to care if they remove something prior to a game going 1.0. You also have games that have been, you know, 15 years in early access, like Project Zombioid or something like that. And that's not including Star Citizen, which isn't really early access. Star Citizen, I think when you look at it, is its own thing. I don't know what you would call it, but I play it. I spent the lowest amount of money to jump into it. I've got my money out of it, and they've definitely talked about curbing any particular growth anywhere else and just locking down the single player, which has been good news for a lot of people. But again, you just look at all these different titles, and I love to support devs. I love the idea of early access, but yeah, I've just been burned so many times. We've talked about it so many times on the podcast that it feels like there's not much more to say. And I get consistently asked what my thought is, or am I going to cover an early access game? And, you know, I will cover it. I won't review them, because I think that's just really weird to review an early access game, because that early access game, even more so than, let's say, a game that gets released and has a this is final idea to it, an early access game, there is no promise of that finality. So the next week they could say, you know what, we don't like this level, we're removing it. And you're just like, damn. And that's actually happened to me with a smaller 2D side-scrolling game where I liked one of the levels. It was rough, but they were just like, yeah, you know, we've decided we're removing this level because it was going to take us too long to iterate it. And, you know, early access, it's on you, right? It's on the person who gave the money. There's nothing I could say about it. But that was one of the reasons why I liked the game. I liked the idea of that level. Let's talk about some news. So recently some news popped that said Witcher 4 is not Witcher 3 in new clothing. And this was by GameSpot, where a dev basically had stated, it's not going to be Witcher 3 in new clothing, which that is fascinating to me, because Witcher 3's success to me personally means that a third person action game with whatever character they do that's open world would be what I would aim for personally. That's just me. If I was writing any type of game, that's what I would do if it had such ultimate success and the DLC had success. So the idea that it's not going to be is quite surprising. And I also want to tell people to probably put their expectations on hold a little bit. Not that I actually think it'll be worse. I actually think that when we get it, we'll most likely see that it is. The only reason I bring that up is because if you have success in something like that, and you are going to, let's say, call it Witcher 4, you are most likely going to want to stick with at least a number of the facets that saw success on the original game. And in this particular case, it's original game plus two massive DLCs. But I like the idea that they aren't worried about going there and surprising people. This is something that we saw recently with one of the heads at Nintendo had stated sort of the same thing with the Switch 2, that they weren't just sticking to, you know, remaking another handheld that's identical but more powerful. My personal opinion, and when I read that story, is along the lines of, hey, it's not going to be Witcher 3 with better graphics. They will be adding stuff. They will be adjusting gameplay. But time will tell. I do like the idea that they're branching out, but I do also, just straight up as a personal request, I do want to see Witcher 4 look a lot like Witcher 3 and play like Witcher 3, because I liked a lot of what and how Witcher 3 played. So I think when you look at that, it would be a little bit like GTA suddenly saying, we're not going to do GTA 6 like GTA 5, and you get GTA 6 and it's a Telltale style game. I don't think anybody should expect that kind of difference. But it was a fascinating story to read about. And certainly when we look at April Fool's, there were people thinking that might have been an April Fool's news, but it wasn't. They were being true to their word. When it comes to Dragon's Dogma, switching around over there for a second, Dragon's Dogma sold 2.5 million copies, which is massive for them. very successful game for them. And I think one of the most successful Capcom games. And then another thing that happened was on Friday, the Stellar Blade demo came out. And the Stellar Blade demo surprised me because there's a lot going on in that game I wasn't expecting. I didn't know if it was going to be parry-based, it was going to be block-based, if it was going to be Devil May Cry, if it was going to be Dark Souls. What I found when I played it was that it was Stellar Blade, which I'm really excited for. And I don't mean excited to review or anything like that. I'm excited that it does feel different. There are elements of it that feel like a lot of other games, but I found attack canceling, blocking, parrying, and there's skills that they show that you're going to be able to get. I looked at it and I was like, you know what? This actually seems, at least to me, to be more interesting than I had initially thought it was going to be. And I'm not talking about the booty physics or anything like that. That's a completely different subject. And you guys know me, I'll rate a game to rate a game. I'll talk about it. If the character looks dumb, I might say it, but I'm not going to really get into it. I'm not too worried about what a character looks like too much unless they just look goofy. Well, it does look a little goofy at times, but that's sort of the Bayonetta style kind of thing. But from what I saw in Stellar Blade, you know, it wasn't perfect. It felt a little bit like Lies of P to me. I want to make sure people understand, I'm not saying like Lies of P's combat, but where Lies of P felt different at times than some of the other games in the same genre. It did its own little thing. And that's what I feel is occurring with Stellar Blade. It's doing its own little segment of that kind of gameplay style. And it looks like what from I'm seeing in the demo, there's a lot of things about it that will just feel like its own game. And that makes me excited. It means that they're not sticking to one particular gameplay style that we've seen in the past. They're not sticking distinctly to Devil May Cry. They're not sticking distinctly to some, you know, super janky open world third person game. It's their own thing. And to me, that's actually more exciting as I continue to play it. I'd love to know what you guys thought of the demo if you tried that demo out. It was sort of unfortunate we got the demo and then they canceled the demo and removed the demo and now it's coming out again because some people have got to play it for a while, some haven't, but everybody should have been able to get their hands on it last Friday, so I'd love to know what you guys think of it. Overall, if you're enjoying it, not enjoying it, you like the graphics, you don't like the graphics, you like the gameplay, and so on. Another thing I'm getting asked about recently, especially just not only from other YouTubers, but people who watch, is like, how does YouTube look for this year when it comes to the channels and stuff like that? Jury's always out. I would say that I'm hearing a lot of people pinging, a lot of YouTubers are pinging me asking about their views being down, different changes to the views. And, you know, that's just sort of YouTube for you. I've always been one of those people that unfortunately gets hurt, you know, first on a lot of their changes. This year, I would say the views are about exactly where I expect. We do the podcast, we do those kind of side things. But when it comes to YouTube, when it comes to TikTok, all of that, I think that especially somebody like myself, you need to diversify. That's why we do have the Discord and we have all the streaming going on in there, because it just makes sense to not really hinge on one particular place, especially when you look at YouTube. You know, a person can't watch two things at once. Well, they can watch two things at once. They could technically bring up two windows, I guess. But when you look at AI and all of the videos that are 10 hours long, that is like AI piping off stuff or super long videos, you know, there's just less time for people to see everything. There's more creators. There's more people out there creating videos, and I've seen a lot of videos that really, you know, I've heard this before where I'll hear somebody say, oh man, the expectations of a video professionalism, not professionalism, but, you know, high bit rate on the recording, all that stuff. That's all that, you know, that's all that matters. And I've seen people doing some stuff that looks like they recorded it on an old cell phone and with audio from a headset, and they do incredibly well. It really just depends on what the algorithm decides. I've seen videos that I've looked at and been, you know, this isn't the greatest video. And I'm not even talking about game videos. I'm talking about any videos. I'll just look at it and be like, yeah, this isn't the best, but it's doing phenomenally well. That's because YouTube in particular has grown to such a wide and divergent audience that the audience no longer is the focus of a channel slash video doing well. There's been a lot of people who are doing great view numbers, but you see that their subscription rate just doesn't go up very high. And then you get ones, I've even had this where I just, you know, don't really get a lot of views on some video, but for whatever reason, that video gets a really high number of subscribers, probably because that video did not go to the normal people. It went to new people. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to explain to anybody who contacts me. And there's a lot of people behind the scenes worried. There's a lot of different channels who've sort of vested themselves in this. And other than diversification, which is hyper important. It's also the idea that there is a possibility that your algorithm, because of when you post, does it get picked up by, let's say, a different speaking nationality, but they like it, or it gets posted to a different group. If that group likes it, it can be pushed to a group that is not your normal group. And so you may get subscribers from them, but you may not get as many views as you expect, or you may get a ton of views and not a lot of subscribers. And this is something that I've noticed for years, probably because the channel grew in a short amount of time. And I've seen two big growth spurts at different times. One, because of the channel and just how I created stuff. And the other, because of some changes I made in creating it. You have to really be sort of open to adjusting things. And I've definitely done that with reviews, even though a long-term person may be like, oh, I don't like that he doesn't separate things perfectly at times or something like that. It's just you try different things because that is what feeds getting newer people in or people continually watching, because YouTube no longer alerts everybody for everybody's uploads anymore. It doesn't. And that was your big source. That was your big feeder. In the last 3 or 4 years, they did an announcement where they're like, we're not doing this. And it's caused a ton of people to be very confused about the algo. So to give you an example, if I upload in the past, prior to this change, I could tell exactly how well a video was doing and who was watching it. Exactly. Because in the past, every single subscriber would get an alert about that video, but that changed years ago. And I've had to change. I think maybe it's because my channel starts with an A, but I noticed this before a lot of other people. There were a couple other people whose channels were started with B or C, or they were randomly chosen, I guess. But I noticed these changes and was talking to people about them years ago. And then it sort of became a thing. YouTube said, okay, we're rolling this out to everybody. We don't have enough bandwidth to inform every subscriber of every single video. Even when you say, by the way, I want to be informed of every video, it no longer always informs you on notifications or email. There's a delay that can occur. And we've seen this. We've replicated it so many millions of times. It probably has to do with the sheer amount of notifications also, that even if somebody is checked to, and they watch every video and they're checked to, you know, and by the way, if you're watching right now, make sure it's notify all, that kind of stuff. Because if it's notify all, you can still ignore the podcast if you don't want to listen to this. And if it's it you watch because of the podcast, you can always ignore the reviews. But if you're notified all, at some point during the day, you're supposed to get a notification. But all this has changed. So YouTube's very different. And this is something that gamers, I want to get this onto gamers, not onto me. When you look at, not gamers, but developers, when you look at developers, this is something they have to feed into. And it's something that's bothered me a little bit. So let me describe something to you that this frustrates me. And I've talked about it just very rarely on the podcast because I guess it just hasn't come up, but it's something that for whatever reason in voice chat, we talk about quite a few times. So what will happen is a game developer will release a trailer, and then sometimes they give that trailer to others or other people upload them. Sometimes you'll get people pretending it's new footage and they'll be like new footage and you're looking at it going, this is not new. Or because they merge a couple trailers together and they'll be like brand new footage and it won't be new. But I'm talking about when a developer releases brand new footage. The developer will do that, but then the bigger channels will take that and they will upload it without any talking on it. And this is one of the things I usually don't do. I upload them and then I talk about it at the end. And I don't even do that very often. And one of the reasons why is because the developer does not get the views. What normally happens is the other channels get the views. Now, we can talk about this in if you agree or disagree on this kind of comparison. But to me, it reminds me of reaction videos. When I watch a reaction video, at least the person, as long as they are, is talking about the video that they're watching, I don't have too much of an issue with that. They are still discussing whatever video they've seen. We can talk about this for hours, and I would love some switches to that, but I'm just saying as a general process. However, if you're just uploading the trailer, that trailer, if you're a bigger channel, might steal from a smaller developer. So you might actually only get the video from your creator, but then the next developer video they do will just be going to them and it won't go to the creator because maybe that day the creator decided to not upload that trailer. And so what happens is you get a lot of small developers who release a video and maybe the first video does 10,000 views, but on somebody else's channel, it does 20,000. So they get sort of some knockoff views. They get some people checking out their game because it looks good or something like that. But at that point, when they upload again, if no one else or the same people don't upload the same trailer on their channels, what you get is barely any views on the developer's channel. And I've actually looked at this a couple hundred times, and it's actually bothersome And I don't know. The only way I would say to be able to fix it would be the developer, when they upload it, saying you cannot take this footage. There's a check in there somewhere that's like, you can't cut this, or maybe you can't embed it. There, I know that one exists, but there's a couple little buttons you can flick. And I don't know if they want to do that, obviously, because they do want those reactions. They do want to have that positive reinforcement when they do a trailer. But that pattern can't be promised unless you're paying a creator or something like that. You know, you can't, you would have to say, hey, this person who does trailer videos, I'm going to release 8 videos this month or these next 2 months on classes, and I would like you to upload all of them. Because if you only upload one, that focus will be on the creator and not on the game. And I've noticed this with some big channels, by the way, some huge gaming game channels, developers channels. They're a big developer. They upload a video and you see it get astronomically low views. And you might see it elsewhere on other people's channels, or you might not. But it definitely means there's a signaling issue on the side of the developers. And I don't know what to say about it, because weirdly enough, I have a lot of people telling me that they're charging developers to talk about their game, or they're charging developers to show their game. We don't, or I don't, it's just me now, but I don't charge that. I assume early access is the thing. Even if they just give me early access to a trailer and I want to talk about it, if I have the time, I would do that. That to me is the pay. You're getting access, and I make my money on the YouTube side. That's the job. That's what I'm supposed to do. I don't charge the developer for talking about it. But it's definitely a situation where signaling about it for the developers become a problem. And I've seen it with, AAA companies. I'm starting to notice it. You'll even notice it on something like, maybe not so Elite. Well, no, I think I noticed it on Elite. I think that was one of the channels I actually first noticed this on. I could be wrong on that. But I noticed it on some big games where they were uploading their videos and the views were going elsewhere. And then they would upload another one and they would give you less and less and less. And you're seeing channels, you know, with game, you know, the game might sell 3 million copies and they're uploading a video and they're getting 1,000 views. And you're all, oh, interesting. So the word's not getting out. And that's really no one's fault. That's just a part of YouTube. And it's a part that the developers are going to have to come to grips with in some way. But as we see YouTube changing and we see it getting bigger, that's how these kind of situations happen. And this can happen to a game company too. They can upload a game at a certain point, a trailer at a certain point, and that might hit, let's say, New Zealand because they're earlier than us, or Australia, and that's their original hit. Maybe they don't get a lot of views. And then by the time the US rolls around, two other companies have released trailers and their trailer gets lost because there's just so many people using YouTube now. Fascinating situation, unfortunate for many, but certainly something that everybody has to take into consideration, and that includes developers, because the YouTubers that I know and myself, we cover the games, but without the games and without them getting feedback and all that kind of stuff, it really isn't going to matter if I'm here, because they'll be gone. And that's one of the things that I've been watching, one of the things I've been sort of looking at and being like, how does that get fixed? And it reminds me, like I said, a little bit of the reaction videos. It's in a different format, but it's still somewhat the same thing. And that's why when I do a trailer occasionally, it's not very often. I'll do maybe 10 in the 7 or 8 years I've been here where I upload a trailer and say, I want to talk about this trailer. It usually has to fascinate me in some way. But and it's not saying it's better than anybody else. It's just a problem I've noticed. And I don't really know how to fix it. But I want the developers to get the views, if that makes sense. I want the person who created it to get the juice, so that the next time they upload, they get that juice again, especially for the next video. Weirdly enough, I was looking in our Discord and Kig just DM'd. He didn't DM, he posted. He says, damn, this is how I know I don't get all videos from you, ACG. And by the way, he's got everything maxed. He said, I got a trailer for Bone Totem on PS5. Found out you did a review 10 months ago. Yeah, I guess that's how you go. And that's, again, just something I'm always looking at. I'm always looking at how developers are going to get the word of their game out there. Speaking of games getting out there, I covered a bunch of games on April. If you didn't get a chance, go check that video. But I was surprised to see this morning, Xbox Game Pass for April is going to include Harold Halibut. Now, Harold Halibut's game, like Almacrog, I talked about, it's 3D items that are sort of adjusted. It's almost like stop motion video. I guess you could say it's pretty much exactly that, but in a game. And I actually think Harold Halibut looks phenomenal. Now, does it look pretty? No, I don't think that's really what it's supposed to look like. It's not necessarily supposed to look pretty, but it definitely looks up my alley when it comes to point-click games, adventure games, exploration games. I was quite surprised to see that on Game Pass. I don't necessarily know why I was surprised. I'm going to be honest. It just was not a game that I expected to see on there. And usually I sort of know or have the assumption of particular games that will come on Game Pass. So to see that popping off, that's quite exciting for them. I think that that's a good idea for them to put that game on Game Pass, get a lot of people playing it. That's it for me. Yeah, it's a short one, but I don't have a ton of time today trying to get this in. Wasn't aware of, well, didn't think that those repairs would happen tomorrow, so I've just sort of been able to jump in here. I would like to know what you guys want to talk about on Friday, though. Feel free to put your topics in, put questions in. We'll try to get to them. If you're a YouTube or a Discord member, feel free to ask me those questions in there. No matter what, I hope you guys have an enjoyable day of gaming, an enjoyable week of gaming. There's a bunch of stuff. Check the demo out for Stellar Blade if you get a chance, or all of these new games coming to Game Pass and PS Plus. It's a phenomenal time to sort of be able to jump in there and see so many games and test out so many with demos. The return of the demo is awesome. Hashtag return of the demo. Peace out.